All right, on this week's episode of Magnifier, we are joined again by the man in the woods, Mr. Kurt. How are we doing today, sir?
I mean, great. I'm in the mountains. What could be wrong?
Yeah, it's not a fake background, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
Beautiful out there. So some of our listeners, watchers may not know who you are. If you want to give a quick 30-second pitch about who you are and what you're doing, we'll get into the show.
Yeah, so I'm one of the small team that helps run Showcase IDX, but I've been a marketer at a whole bunch of high growth technology companies, including those that have billions of dollars of annual revenue. And so I'm a scaler. So I think that's what we're going to talk about here today. And so
yes.
That's kind of where I've been throughout my career. And so I tend to follow into marketing and operations roles, but really it's all about how do we put in place things and process that really add like a 5x or even 50x to what the business was before.
Yeah. That's exactly what we are talking about today. You know, a lot of agents get themselves in a position where their business, they need to start hiring people. They need to start building a team in order for them to actually reach that kind of next level of gross commission and kind of thing. And then some of our marketing partners, our web developer partners, same thing. You get to a point, you need to start scaling. How do you do it? It's kind of hard to know who the first hire should be, all that kind of stuff. So I guess the first question is, you know, baseline level, how do you scale? What are the first things you're looking for?
I think one of the things that when that question begs to me is, like, I think for everybody, we may have a different definition of what scaling means. And I think the first thing is, like, what is scaling? Because so often I talk to agents or somebody that may run a marketing agency, and they're trying to figure out how do they 3X, 5X, 10X their business. And that's great. But it's very rare that you see these big step functions that happen. I mean, they do on SaaS platforms with technology. And but other than that, it's really much more about how do you put in place processes and things that are going to allow you to grow consistently. And I still want to get to that 5X, that 10X growth as quickly as possible. But understanding that it's going to come from a bunch of 1%, 2% incremental things that either I or my team are going to do incrementally. And so, hey, we all wanted to have that big jump, but we need to plan on, like, not things that do that major jump and more things about, hey, how do I offload things that will multiply myself or multiply my business? And we'll get there in time. Don't try to do it overnight. So that's the first part for me about how do you scale. So
I love that. Yeah. You know, for those of you guys that don't know, my background is as well as real estate. I come from the fitness and the health space. So that, you know, that kind of philosophy, it holds true for everything. You've got to start. It's all the small changes, you know, small changes lead to big results. And that applies to scaling businesses and all that kind of thing for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think for everything,
so, you know, on a day-to-day basis, what kind of things are you looking at, in terms of how someone should be operating when they're looking to scale?
Yeah. I mean, it does start with that day one of deciding, hey, I want to actually put in place some things that are going to magnify my business. And so for me, that's just starting even on the first day but it's a continual process of, I'm very regimented in defining jobs to be done. And so, and breaking those down, hey, if you think the job to be done is creating a community page or a blog post, that's not the job to be done. There's five jobs within that you need to define. These are the steps that are jobs to be done to get to there. And that's important because, like, if you come up with a thing that's like, hey, like a single blog post isn't going to change your real estate business, but 100 might, 30 might, if they're the right ones. And so what are the jobs to be done to get to that? And by breaking them down, it allows you to start to split things into shallow work and deep work. And for those that aren't familiar with this book by Cal Newport, it's, hey, shallow work is this very light level stuff where it's like you could be brain dead. You may have been up for two nights. You may be on a Zoom call and be able to do it, you know, while still listening and participating in that Zoom call. While deep work is something like the process of writing those blog posts. Look, very rarely can somebody be interrupted frequently by kids or phone calls or clients and churn out 2,000 words of content. That's deep work that you have to get into that process for. Well, when you start to think like that and you go, okay, if I want 30 blog posts for my website, how do I break those things up and jobs to be done? Well, you can batch things into coming up with ideas for coming up with blog posts, doing the research to decide, hey, what are the topics you should actually write on based on competition and difficulty versus volume and to get the ROI. Writing outlines. We may talk a little bit on here. Like, I'm really big on writing content briefs. Like, that's all before I actually sit down to write. And then even once I had that written down, there's a job to be done of actually choosing an image for my website and then publishing that out. That sounds very complicated to people, but the problem is you'll never do 30 blog posts or 100 blog posts in a year if you don't break it into those level of actions, because it's hard to do 30 blog posts front to back doing all of those steps, but it's really easy to come up with 200 blog post ideas that you then narrow down to say, here's the 30 I actually need to write. That those are easier chunks to break things up into. And that's what scaling looks like, no matter what kind of part of your business you're in. Because then you also decide, wow, like if I'm thinking about how to scale, just batching that work up into things that are the same type of task is very helpful. But you also start to see maybe there's things that are really worthwhile to hand off. And so that's a little bit we might want to talk about.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going to go to next, is at what point do you decide this is something I need to hand off? Should you kind of wait until you have gotten good at that practice of deep work, shallow work, because you may end up finding that you could actually keep some of that for yourself, but you haven't figured out the process yet.
Yeah. I mean, I think you actually need to start writing down what those steps are as quickly as possible. Doesn't mean you hand it off yet, but you need to document it, because that working on the processes you mentioned, that's really important. Like I have a content team that produces somewhere between 250 and 400,000 words of unique content on a monthly basis. Now there's a lot of people on that team, but I worked on kind of as the mad scientist perfecting what that process is that I handed off to them. And I probably handed off in December. I started handing off in December of this year. I worked on it for 6 months. Like I probably completely broke it down and redid it three times during that process as well, where I'm like, I've got it. And then like, I try to do it myself for a couple of weeks. And I'm like, no, I don't have it. And so, but literally each one of those steps, I've got a Google Doc, or I tend to think in Google Sheets, more like an engineer, where I can do nested tasks. And, so I think documenting it from day one is kind of really important. And then it is looking at that to say, I mean, some of whether you hand it off does depend on your business. Like there's a book called Profit First. If you're an agent and you haven't read it, you should. It's nothing to do about real estate. It's probably geared much more to the audience that you have that are those running marketing agencies. But it's that whole concept of you need to make sure you're paying yourself, because if you're not stable, like this isn't a long-term growth thing for you. But no. Then it's looking at what those options are. I mean, if I hand off something to somebody who it's a full-time job, they probably expect a full-time salary. And if that's in the US, like that's a long time down the road for most agents. But you can go to a website like hiremymom.com, which I love going to find people that are looking for anywhere from a couple of hours a week to dozens of hours on a weekly basis. Some cases that have been like VPs of marketing at very established companies. And like, depending on who you're getting and what you're needing and the flexibility you have in your schedule, you can have a super qualified people at not that like full budget price. And so I think when you hand off something really depends to me a lot on what the cost is. And I mean, I'm very risk averse from a financial perspective. And so, if you listen to somebody like Grant Cardone or Gary Vaynerchuk, they're going to be like, go hire that person day one. And I'm going to be much more the Dave Ramsey that says, you need to have it planned out, even if you can do them on the cheap early on. And you need to make sure you're handing off things that makes financial sense for you in the longer term. Like if you start, we stay with a blog post idea. I want you to be in something consistent that you're going to do for at least 6 months, because it's going to take that long to see a Google response. And so plan for 6 to 9 months of however you can pay for it to hand off the work. And if you can't have that ahead of time, don't do it. Because otherwise, if you get 3 months in, Google hasn't responded yet, you don't see leads coming, or the market stays slow in the case of real estate, like you're going to kind of burn out and feel negative on that. And like you may have been on the perfect trajectory, and I don't want you to get off the path at that point. And so that's kind of a big thing for me. But there's so many small pieces you can hand off on cheap. Like go hire a full-time writer, go hire somebody that can write the whole thing for you. But like, that's a skill set. That's very different than, hey, if you're an agent, I want you writing blog posts or writing content for community pages on your website. And so do you need to have somebody else write that content? I don't think most agents do. Most agents just get blocked whenever I say, I need you to write. And that freaks them out. But if I could call you and say, hey, tell me about this subdivision in Hoboken, and tell me why I should live there or not. And you could talk to me on the phone for 3 to 5 minutes without even thinking about it. And so, like, okay, Mr. and Mrs. Agent, take out your phone, do a voice memo, record it, and then send it something like rev.com or one of the freelance sites I mentioned, or and let them transcribe it for you. I mean, rev.com is $1 a minute. They'll remove all your ums and pauses from it as well. So you talk for 5 minutes on why somebody should move to a subdivision, pay $5 and you'll get it back as a transcription. That's 90% of the way to your article right there. Oh, all right. Froze for a minute. Still there?
All right, I lost you for a second there. All right. Hear me now?
Yes. Well, Riverside should be recording on our side. So
it will have recorded whatever you said.
All right.
It records locally.
Well, the other thing I would just add to that would be there are certain things as an agent that you're not going to be efficient at doing. And the one that jumps out to me is link building. And so link building is it fundamentally, don't expect people to link to your site unless you pay them. But that it's a business development role. It's somebody has basically a salesperson that follows up, sends out outreach, does a follow up with these websites. And it's like, that's something that you do need to pay for. And you can start doing that part of scaling. I mean, as early as you have budget.
Yeah. One piece of advice I got a long time ago, was figure out how much your time is worth. So like, what is your hour worth? And then start outsourcing some of your personal things that would take away from time you could be putting into your business. Something like taking your clothes to the dry cleaner or running the kids to school. You know, I don't really like paying for taking kids off your hands, but you know, those kind of things. So that's always, you know, one way to look at it too. You know, when you're looking to scale, just take some of the personal things away so you can have more time to focus on the business stuff.
Yeah. Well, and even you mentioned kids. I mean, with that, I think too many people look toward, it does depend on the age of your kids. Like you and I have younger kids, but I think too often people miss the opportunities to actually raise good adults rather than, you know, like get by with the kids that they have, where it's like, hey, if you have a 14-year-old daughter, I guarantee she can help you with your WordPress site. You have a 15-year-old son, he can help you with that transcription or writing your articles. And so I think as an agent where it's like, look for opportunities where, like, even before, like, perfect what your process could be before maybe you do go to hiremymom.com and bring in somebody that's consistent with you. But maybe as you mad scientist things in your house, you use your teenagers or college age kids as your kind of VAs that help you work and refine the process. But it also brings them into the business a little bit to understand things. Like, I think too often people miss the opportunities to be like, hey, teach your kids what a budget looks like. Well, this is a great way to walk them through the early stages. And then even later on where it's like, hey, now you've helped me figure this out. Now I've brought on this virtual assistant and we can hand off some of that together. And you might even be able to, like, at that point, have them help manage that virtual assistant. And like, that's what a household should look like to me. I mean, until like 30 years ago, people would have just thought that way, by nature. And now it's kind of like, well, my kids need to be kids. And it's like, no, they need to have downtime like you do, but you can teach them things by bringing them into the business almost as peers in ways that you just never could, before kind of the digital environment we're all in today.
Yeah, it's funny. Vaynerchuk talks about that a lot, right? How his dad brought him into the wine business, and that's what really got them close. Like, his dad wasn't able to be home a lot, so you know, he sacrificed those years, but built a good relationship with him working with him.
Yeah.
So there's always that too. So when it comes to, you know, you've got a team in place, I think a lot of entrepreneurs have a hard time figuring out how to lead that team. A lot of people kind of want to take the responsibilities on themselves. They have a hard time letting things go. Kind of talk through some of your ideas on leadership. I know that's one of the things you're great at, and you know, being a leader of mine, I can speak to that.
might have, you know, a little choppiness experience, but
now, how do you go about leading a team when you've never had to do it before?
Let's see if we come back here. All right. So how do you lead a team? So I think one of the things there is, too often people who haven't led a team before, they fall into the default of leading, leading through authority. And that ends up really limiting their ability to grow. I mean, most of us, unfortunately have worked for that boss who, they were that hard ass that, I mean, underlying pretty much everything they said, they tended to be micromanagers, and underneath just about everything they told us to do was, this underlying threat was, do it my way in the time that I tell you, or I'll fire you. And anybody that's actually a high performer is going to leave that environment as quickly as they can. Unless, I mean, in some cases, even if you can pay them just through the teeth, they're still going to leave. And so I really believe in following kind of a high achieving servant leadership approach, where my job as the leader is to love on the people that I'm working with, help them see the outcomes I'm trying to reach in the business. And at that point, then I am giving them jobs to be done. The list we kind of talked about before. I'm looking for bottlenecks that are holding them back from getting those things done. But I'm always making sure that they understand, I'm asking you to do this two or three things because this is the outcome I'm hoping to get. And then sharing the results of that afterwards, because then there's just built-in accountability from that as well. Like, they're seeing the results of, hey, if they did a half-assed job, well, we're seeing half-assed results. That's a problem. You really dug in. Well, then then you see the results of that as well. And so I think it's really about, you know, treating people well enough that also, like, if you do find a way to scale, like, what you want is high achievers that want to stay in your team, but also when you're hiring the next role, you want them to take personal time to go invite their friends or family to come work for you because of the type of person you are. Like, high performers want to be around high performers. And so that's a big thing to kind of, like, I think, treat your people in a way that says, hey, if when I'm able to hire the next 1, 2, 7 people, you will want to vouch for why people should come work on this team. And so when you do that, people will perform well.
How much leeway do you give people on the team in terms of doing things their way? Because it's kind of hard, you know, you want them to do it their way, but I mean, you want them to do it your way, but at the same time, like you said, if you're too authoritative, you can end up kind of stifling them, and they don't kind of fulfill their potential as a member of the team.
Yeah, it depends on the exact processes. If it's things like an SEO checklist, certain things that need to be done to help that article rank, I'm going to be much more regimented on what the process is for following, but I'm going to be very open to people coming to me with suggestions about how we should iterate on that process. So follow the process until we agree to change the process. If it's on other things, though, it does really depend on you know, like, I want to hire smart people. And the worst thing you can do is hire smart people and then do their job for them. And so, hey, how should somebody respond? You know, if you have somebody who's helping set up meetings for you, well, you probably want to make sure that you have some pretty strict guidelines about they treat your clients with respect. They respond in a certain amount of times. But other than, like, some of those very broad things, like the exact word they use, like, you know, even how they follow up, like, I think that's where you should really trust people to do well by themselves. I mean, we have a woman on one of my teams that creates graphics, and it's like, we gave some pretty general guidelines initially to see what she'd come up with. And then came back with feedback a good bit. She comes up with all of the graphics for showcaseidx.com. And I can't remember actually when I gave any direction actually on those graphics. I have guidelines that says I want a featured image and I want at least 1 to 3 images within the article. But as far as the content within those, like, I check them over periodically and I don't kind of come back. I think one of the things too that I kind of, I guess I do this by nature now, is I hate being viewed as the boss, but I mean, anybody that's a leader, you're writing a paycheck, you're a boss, to some level. And it's kind of like, I think, with a parent giving giving feedback to a child as well, is if I have feedback that can meaningfully change like the quality of the work being done, and by meaningfully, I mean like a 50% increase or better in quality, I'll probably speak up. If it's a 5 to 10, 15% increase, I will usually hold my tongue because it's hard for that not to come across as criticism. So I'm going to find ways to give positive feedback on the things I really like. If somebody asks for it later, or I may batch up content, I may give some feedback then. But I mean, there's a lot of things I'm good at. And so I could probably go through most articles or most graphics and make them 10% better. But is it worth the demotivation that I would give to people on my team by doing that on every single graphic that was created? It feels weighty to them. And so as opposed to just, you know, congratulating them for where they're at and letting people grow themselves. I mean, people generally want to do a good job and they're growing themselves. So as you see them growing, it's different to come back and go, hey, that last blog post, the graphics that you did, or that content that you wrote, or whatever the topic was, gosh, I see the improvement from 10 before or 20 before. That's a positive motivator. That's different than every time going, ooh, could you tweak this shade of green a little bit? Like, that just feels not, it is nitpicky. It could make it better, but it just like, nobody wants to be in that environment.
No, yes, yeah, it's very unmotivating or demotivating, and it definitely stifles creativity for sure. When you're looking to hire people, maybe it doesn't necessarily have to be how you hire people, but what are the things that people should put weight in? Should it be experience? Should it be something you see in them that you think they could apply, or some skill sets that they have that they could reallocate to certain things? Like, what are you looking for when you hire? When you hire people?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are certain things where, I mean, I would look for skill sets. I'm looking for somebody to help me with bookkeeping or somebody to do graphics. I'm going to expect them to have at least a certain level of skills in those areas. But for the most part, I kind of believe in hiring good athletes, and then you put them in a position and let them do what a good athlete will do, is that they will adapt and grow. And so you'll get so many people that'll come to you for any role you're hiring for, or a freelance role, or somebody you're going to for the consulting at the gig, that'll step up and go, hey, I can write good content. That's great. But I look for things that people will display both in the interviewing process, and then especially in that first 60 to 90 days, where their actions tell me who they really are. Some of the things that I really look for is I look for things like a bias towards action. I want people that aren't just going to like, hey, I have this problem, that are going to sit on their hands. I want people that they want to move forward with that. They're going to come forward and go, hey, I have this thing from a customer or from somebody who was wanting to set up an appointment. You're booked. And that they may come with two or three solutions already for that. Like, that's a bias towards action. I want people who, I love this term for telling people what I'm hiring for. I love people that understand that I want healthy conflict in the office or on the team, because there's no way to get out of conflict. And so often today I hear people they're trying to like just stay away from conflict at all times. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you're generally the most conflict person that I know that says that, because things build up over time until it becomes a boiling point and somebody will quit or get fired. I'd rather somebody bring up an issue so early where it's not really an issue. It's a concern or a feeling at that point. You can't even fully articulate it. Like, that's a healthy conflict. And so without bringing up things well and early, well, you're going to end up with dysfunction later on. Well, you will see that in people's actions. So like when I'm interviewing people, I will explicitly ask them about that, especially if I'm hiring like freelancer help. And usually I won't go to hire somebody for just like a couple hours here. If I'm looking for freelancer or part-time help, like I'm looking for somebody that I'm telling them, I'm going to want to work with you for at least a year and possibly ongoing. And so I'm going to ask them about that healthy conflict. Hey, I'm going to give you an assignment. I'm going to come to you with a blog post and a voice recording. And like, when would you push back to me on that? Like I just had this issue where I had a guest writer helping me with an article. And I'm reading the article draft that they gave me back, and I'm reading this first section, and there was this third tier of bullets where there were two sets of repeats. And I'm like, how would they make this mistake? And I started to type a note back, and I went and checked the content brief that I gave them. I made up the content brief, the outline for the article. I screwed up. So they went through and wrote an article where clearly at the outline stage, they would have read title, subheading, and then like a list of five sections within there. And I had four of those, two and two, that were just duplicates. I don't know how, I mean, my mistake. They wrote the article as if that's the way it was supposed to be. No, there's no way anybody would have thought that. They should have looked at that outline and said there wasn't a mistake, but they didn't push back on me. That, like, that was a miss both on me because I made the mistake, but on them because they didn't push back on me early on. And so, like, healthy conflict would have solved that.
Yeah, definitely. So you've seen, you've worked with a lot of successful people, you're successful yourself. What are some of the habits? We'll stick to three daily habits that you see successful team leaders do or practice.
Yeah. Let's go with one that may be unique to me. And then I've got a hard one and an easy one. One that's, I think unique to me, is that, when I mentor people, they hate hearing this, but they're like, every day, I ask myself, what am I wrong about in my business today? And not even what might I be wrong about. I know I'm wrong about at least two or three fundamental things in my business today. Because when I look back historically over the decades and the companies that I've helped, there's always been things that come up where it's like, you find out you've been doing this or you've been having your team do something for 6 months or 2 years. Hell, in some cases, I've written $100,000 checks to angel investment companies where I thought all of those things were the right idea, the best idea at the time, and something changed. And you look back and I realize I was Wile E. Coyote out over the cliff. And that was the wrong decision for that whole back time period. And so I think it's very useful to both ask yourself and ask others on the team, what could I be wrong about today that I think I'm actually right about? Don't take too long on it, but it's a 2 minute exercise every day, just because it gets you in that process of sometimes identifying those things earlier, but it makes you humble because you realize I know I'm wrong about something and I need to be open to those on my team, whether it's somebody that's full time or somebody that I just give like 2 hours of work to on a monthly basis. They might see something that I don't see. And if I'm not open to hearing that, I'll never hear it. So that's a big Kurt habit. Now a hard one for me is true quiet time. So whether you're a person of faith or not, quiet time is no podcast, no Netflix. If you're a person of faith, it's you're not reading a daily devotional. Like, that's not quiet time. Quiet time is exactly what it is. There's no music. It's just quiet. And for somebody like me that has really bad tinnitus, that's a hard thing too, because I truly never have like full quiet. But that full that full quiet for somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes a day, if you can do more, that's great. But you don't have to break the bank on this. It changes the rest of your thing, and it's really hard for people because, like, I listen to podcasts on 2 to 3x. I listen to audiobooks on 3x whenever I can, and so like, there's always so much information in our heads. Most of us are very uncomfortable with silence. And so you might literally have to start with just 30 yeah. seconds a day. Cause I mean, I have seen CEOs of like $10 and $20 million companies where I told them to do, they had like to keep mentoring that they have to do this quiet time with pure silence. In their case, I can be more prescriptive. Like, for them, I'm telling them they have to do 5 to 10 minutes a day to get started. And grown men in their 40s and 50s cry when they recount how difficult that time for the last week has been. And because they never have silence. Wow. And so when you start getting silence, you start to feel emotions. And that's a hard thing for a lot of people. But it'll change your business. It'll change your business because it'll mature you so much.
Now, is that meditation or it's a bit less guided and more internal?
Much less guided. If you go with more Eastern meditation, it is trying to kind of empty yourself. I'm much more on pure silence and with my faith anyways, I try to center my time and just focus back on hearing God. That's different than talking. And it's different than listening. It's just trying to like reset my mind and what I'm paying attention to. And so I'm doing less of trying to empty my mind and more of trying to have one thing that I'm focused on. I mean, I have one friend. I mean, he literally just stares at either a chair or a tree. That's his focus. He's just trying to hone his mind from going everywhere to just going to, and he's not trying to empty it. He's trying to center it and just keep it locked on one thing. And so it's different than what I think most people would say, would think about when they think in terms of meditation, and much more of a solid focus time. And acknowledging your mind is going to drift. Okay. It's going to go this way. You can try to focus on the tree or try to focus on God. Your mind will try to go this way and you'll just go, nope, I need you to come back. That's normal. And it'll get better and stronger over time.
Any recommendations? Because I think I might try that myself. Any recommendations on where to do it, at the environment you should put yourself in? Should it be a dark room or a light room? What are some tips for that?
The only tip is it needs to, if you can, it's a consistent place. I know people, they write tips about it. In the Christian world, this used to be a concept that's now pretty kind of outdated, but it was called the daily office. About how it was done, but it's like, some people say like you close your eyes. Some people say you open your eyes. Some people say you do need to have a light music. Like, I've heard all sorts of things, and I'm like, you know what I hear consistently from people that actually have done this, and hundreds of people now have kind of helped kind of move through it, is it's the consistency. It's having one chair, one spot, maybe the same time of day, but maybe you can't do that because of kids or what's going on. And it's having that, but you may walk into that place and that helps you kind of center down at that time.
Yeah, I love that. So what about the easy one? You said you had an easy one.
Yeah, the one easy one, and I'd say it's easy, is it will get to be really easy. For a lot of people, it's not, is 3 minutes of gratitude. Don't go too long. Don't go more than that. But you also need to stretch yourself. And I say stretch because I think a lot of people live in just a world of negativity. They live in a world of scarcity. And I'm not a law of attraction person, but you get what you focus on type of thing. And so we all live with just such abundance and so many wonderful things in our lives, but we don't view it that way. I mean, I could wake up every day and just go back the litany of ways that people have harmed me in my past, and I'd be miserable today. I could also wake up and go, hey, what are all the wonderful ways that people have done things for me in the past, or what's a wonderful blessing today? And so 3 minutes seems to be about the sweet spot for me of looking for what should I be grateful for in my life, even if I'm really not. You've heard this from me. Like, I actually send people shirts that say assume positive intent. It helps getting you to that same thing. It's like, hey, somebody on your team is late in getting you a deadline. Well, okay. Well, maybe you should assume positive intent about something that's going on in their life, but shouldn't you be grateful if somebody just wants to work with you? Like, lots of people could pay their bills. Like, you give somebody $100 or $10,000. Anybody could give them that amount of money. They choose to work with you. Like, you should be grateful about that. And so there's a long list of things you can be grateful for. And some will be repeating day over day. And others, like in 3 minutes, you'll find that's enough time to stretch yourself and go, I'm really kind of happy. Like, hey, a coffee mug from the team trip to Banning Mills last year. It's like, I'm using this today. Like, this was actually in my 3 minutes of gratitude today. It was like, I'm just really glad we could structure things for us to get away and I'll go spend some time together in there. Like, that was probably 15 to 20 seconds of my moments of gratitude today.
And you're writing this stuff down, or you're just saying it to yourself in your head?
It's a good question. I'm not too legalistic on most things. And so I care much more about the process and what works for you. I would say when I got started, I wrote down a good bit. And there's some part of me that I wish I was like a journaler. I wish I was somebody that wrote things down. But I know whenever I tried putting that ends up being a blocker for me. There's something about where's my journal, or I got to pull out a Google Doc or my phone notes or anything, or I have my phone out that I'm going to go check out Facebook or TikTok or something. And so I did for a little while when I got started with it. And then at least personally, like, I don't need that to stay in the 3 minutes. I actually use my watch a lot. My wife always recommends, like, use technology to your advantage. I'll forget things. My watch doesn't go off for me to show up. And so I'll set my watch for three minute timer. And that lets me get started. And very often it goes off and I'll still go for a few more minutes. But that's about the only legalistic thing I do, is I need to make sure I'm spending at least 3 minutes.
Yeah, but the gratitude one, I think one of the big benefits of that is that you end up, like you said, you assume positive intent, and it will start formulating outside of those 3 minutes. Everything during the day, during your work week, like you said, if someone's late with a deadline, or if you know, with real estate agents, if someone offers you a below the belt offer, or you know, something like that, you start reacting differently to it, and then you start making better decisions for yourself, for your business. So it's one of those like domino effects when you start practicing that.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, and you could be a hard negotiator and still be filled with love and gratitude. It's like people want to work with nice people, and so it helps to shift that a little bit too. I mean, people that have been on calls with me with vendors. I mean, my wife is just a crazy hard negotiator. I'm not quite that hard, but it's like, you know, 3 minutes of gratitude makes me, I think, easier to be around it sometimes as well. Because otherwise, like, you know, there's some hard edges there, and so you know, I don't want to always bristle those up against others.
Yeah. All right, this has been a great chat. I'm trying to keep these episodes to a sociable amount of time. Where can people find you if they want to find out more? I know you're writing a lot more now. You've got your blog going, so I'm going to give the address for that. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, my personal website is kurtuehler.com, and so I write a lot on there about high achieving servant leadership, hyper growth, and how to do some of these processes we were talking about.
Awesome. Well, Kurt, always a pleasure. We'll have you on again soon for some more wisdom.
All right. Thanks for having me.